If needlework is your passion, whether you're stitching by hand, machine, or mixing it all up, you're going to want to hear about the Mr. X Stitch Contemporary Needlework Prize 2025. This prize celebrates the best in modern stitch and it's open to creatives from all around the world, whether you're a student or an emerging artist or a seasoned professional. And the best part, you don't have to send your work anywhere. Just upload high-resolution images to a private folder we will send you after you enter. You can enter more than one category, for instance, hand embroidery and 3D textiles. Just grab an entry for each one. And if you've got a student ID, you can get 50% off the entry price as well. The deadline for entering is 30th of June 2025, and entries are now open at xstitchmag.com/prize-entry. Thanks to our brilliant sponsors, Bookmarked Hub by Search Press and David and Charles, and the legends at Lowry Workstands. If you've got the stitch bug, this is your time. Show us what you've got. Enter the prize now. Visit xstitchmag.com/prize-entry to get your ticket today. Welcome to Needle Exchange, where thread and thought intertwine. I'm your host, Jamie Chalmers, aka Mr. X Stitch, and in this episode, I'm talking with Neve Wimperis, an embroidery artist and craft entrepreneur whose creative journey bridges fine art, personal healing, and small business savvy. In this first part of our conversation, we explore Neve's creative roots, from studying photography to discovering embroidery as an emotional and artistic outlet. She shares how pain, both physical and emotional, informed her early works, how her practice has evolved from bold feminist statements into more gentle acts of resistance, and we talk about the journey that she went on prior to launching her own embroidery business. Neve's a great person. I got to know her at a recent Stitch Festival, but she's been on the scene for quite a while and deservedly making a success of it. If this exploration of embroidery as a personal and political tool resonates with you, then you'll enjoy Needle Exchanges 71 and 72 with Betsy Greer, aka the godmother of craftivism. And if you have enjoyed the show, don't forget to subscribe and share Needle Exchange with your stitching circle. I'll be back next week with the second part of our conversation, where we really dig into Neve's business and obviously find out about the things that touch her from a cultural standpoint. But for now, here's Neve. Enjoy the show. So I've got two girls, Flora and Annie. Flora just turned 8. Annie is going to be 6 soon. Flora's convinced that hell is a thing, right?
Right.
And I'm not. She's like, hell's a thing, isn't she? And I'm like, no. She keeps telling Annie. She keeps saying to Annie, you know, not that you'll go to hell, but hell is a thing. If you do bad things in your life, you'll end up going to hell. And I'm like, I have opinions. And I'm like, no, this is not possible, because it's not like saying hell is just on the outskirts of Cheltenham. It doesn't work like that. It can't physically be a place, you know. It's like, she's like, no, but it could be in another universe. But I'm like, no, but a universe is on this side of life, and hell can't, like, and she won't go through it. I'm trying to think why I'm starting with that gambit now. Oh, no.
You were saying that you were in the void space. Was it something to do with...
Oh, yeah, that was it. Thank you. Yeah, so then I was saying, actually, if you think about it, I didn't want to be too much of a downer. But to be honest, you know, they say, like, hell is being with other people. Or like when I'm in a room like this and it's just a magnolia office with no daylight and stuff, I think this might be hell.
That might be hell.
And I mean, I'm sure there's people who work in like lithium mines who would argue differently or whatever. But I was just trying to say to them, I'm just like, like all there is when you die is heaven. But you can call it heaven, you can call it light, you can call it love, you can call it God, you can call it Reiki, you can call it bliss, you can call it whatever.
Yeah.
But that's all there is because of physics. There's no like, oh, but you skew to the left and you end up in a shoebox in a puddle.
You accidentally kicked your dog. You're going that way.
And I don't know where she's got it from as well, because I've always tried to eschew like Taoism type things. You know, my wife's very keen on doing things with nature. Flora understands all this stuff. So I don't know where she's got this from.
That is weird.
I'm just like, that is quite weird. You've got kids, right?
No.
Have you not?
No.
Oh.
No, I'm just the wrinkled visage of somebody who does. No, the idea of having kids after hearing that is quite terrifying. I don't really know how to argue against that.
No, but the thing, well, there's two ways you can go. You can either go, just believe what I say,
yeah,
because I'm your dad and I must be right. Or you can try it, like, the whole thing with kids, I think, is just about you, A, trying to look at the best of life and then maybe trying to explain life to other people. You know, like, you learn through teaching, don't you? So I suppose in some ways you spend a lot of time just learning about the world. Like, that conversation's a great one. And we're having the conversation as we're walking to school.
Yeah.
So it's like, no, but hell, but you don't understand, Flora, like, hell can't be a thing. There's no set of judgments that can be held up universally that, oh, hi, morning. Yeah, no, nice to see you, thanks. That can be held up to sort of say, and you're just like, oh, I can't do it. I can't context switch. No, I'm fine. Yeah, I know. I've got to drink a lot of water. But anyway, Flora, so, yeah, because in some countries, they'll say, this is hell.
Oh, God.
It's never a dull moment, really. So that was quite good. Anyway, let's start. No, do you know what I was going to ask you, right? So you did a piece for that was in the Broderers exhibition 2020 called This Is Art.
I did, yeah.
And I really liked it. What was that, like stitching on the top of some fabric, but stitching the pattern underneath?
Yeah, so I went to a charity shop and found a canvas painting. So it was an actual painting, it was like oil painting, and stitched over the top, and I stitched the words "This is art" and color matched as best to my ability what was underneath. So in certain lights you can't really see the stitching. And the idea behind that is I wanted to submit it to the Royal Academy summer show, because historically they wouldn't accept that any form of needlework was art.
Mm.
And so I thought, you know, screw that. Like,
yeah.
I'm going to prove that it is art. They rejected it, so clearly.
I'm afraid not.
Yeah, clearly that standard still holds up.
I did something similar once. I got a cross stitch from a charity shop of this Victorian couple standing. I got two sets of them, and one I put them on a disco floor, nice, a disco background, as I stitched for one. But with the other ones, they're literally, one's just saying to the other, is this art? And I thought, by doing that, I'm making art question itself, and it might have been the most artistic thing I'd ever done in my life.
Yeah.
But it's fascinating, isn't it? Because you're just like, come on, people.
Yeah.
But the thing that I noticed, or the thing I was going with, is that that was something where you were pissed off.
Yeah.
And I know that you did a BA in photography and then you did a master's in contemporary craft
with this,
yeah,
focus on embroidery. Yeah.
But you were pissed off and now you're not pissed off.
Yeah.
And I'd like to explore that. I think that's interesting because we all go through, I think there's a lot of that context, that thing of needlework as an art form, needlework as a gender, all of that sort of stuff is something you have to work through. And I'm interested to get what happened with you on that journey.
Yeah. I mean, I think I sort of just stitched through the frustration and kind of, yeah, particularly with that piece. I don't know. I found it a very kind of meditative process. It was also a very physically difficult process because I was stitching it sat on the floor. So that and I've got rheumatoid arthritis, and at the point that I was stitching it, it was like uncontrolled rheumatoid arthritis. Like I was just in pain constantly. And so I was sat cross-legged on the floor with this canvas painting draped over the side of the table so I could like get to the back of it, kind of feeling, you know, kind of mental anger at what the piece represented, but then also the physical pain of creating the piece. So quite a lot of sort of feeling went into that one. And yeah, then like I say, it was rejected and I was like, oh, okay. I'm just going to have this on my wall.
Yeah. And it's beautiful. A lot of the stuff that you did early on was pretty political then.
Yeah.
It came out like punching. And what motivated that?
Yeah, I think certainly when I started, there was a lot of sort of feminist based things, like, you know, quite inspired by the work that like Hannah Hill, Anecdote, was doing, kind of using this art form that historically had not been considered an art form and kind of using it to portray that message of like, like feminine strength, I suppose, you know, this art form that has so long been associated with women and therefore been sort of looked down on. And you know, I think quite a lot of embroiderers, like female embroiderers, kind of go through that journey of using it as a way to get a political message out, I think.
The juxtapose.
Yes. Yeah. Like, you know, the first time I tried cross stitch, which is not my thing. I tried it, but the first thing I stitched was the word plant. Like, you know, so right, what can we, because you just do, don't you?
Yeah, you do. Yeah. Number of F-bombs I stitched back in the day. You got to work it out. Like, yeah. Similar, right? So the first time I was ever a Santa, I've got a bit of a Santa track record, but for my daughter's school, yeah. I got the costume. I was a pro Santa for a season at Alton Towers. I know how to Santa, baby. But the first time I sat in that, I was sitting there going, drink Coca-Cola. And I was like, go fuck yourself. Because you felt like you had to do it. You had to rebel inside this context to kind of feel it out.
Yeah, yeah. You've got to really subvert for sure. And, you know, like when I did my master's in contemporary craft, like sort of one of the main books that I read was The Subversive Stitch and, you know, kind of drawing a lot of inspiration from that. And I think, you know, I started stitching when I was 21 and I was feeling really lost and really sort of like frustrated with myself on not knowing what to do with myself. And as the years have progressed, kind of just mellowed out, basically. And I think, which is why it's kind of a lot less political now than it was, because I'm tired.
I can totally dig it. I can totally dig it, because you can't. Like I've said this for so long, there's few people that I can think of that are still stuck in the same ragey position that they were, say, 10 years ago.
Yeah. You know?
I don't think you can, because you've got to evolve as a human. And if you are stuck in that, then I genuinely think like the meditative process of needlework pushes you beyond that.
Yeah.
Because you can't sort of help it, can you?
Yeah. No, I definitely agree with that. Yeah. I think my master's, I made a blanket fort, like a collaboratively stitched blanket fort for it. And so it was, in a way, a really political piece, because this was like 2015, 2016. So like Trump and Brexit and all this kind of really scary stuff was happening. And kind of rather than going for anger, I sort of reverted back to childhood. So built this childhood blanket fort as a kind of place of safety, so you could come and sit in and just kind of feel like really nicely enclosed. And I did the collaborative embroidery on the back kind of sheet of the blanket fort, and that was all flowers that have like meaning in the Victorian language of flowers. So the meaning of the flowers was still like kind of anger and resistance and stuff, but it was a lot less punch you in the face, I'm furious. It was more just like, let's sit and stitch together and kind of work through and talk through what we're feeling, and like, you know, that, yeah. So it's still political, but it was a lot less furious.
Did you come to that naturally?
Yeah, I think I did. Yeah, but I liked that the meaning and the anger was still there if you looked for it. You know, if you knew what these flowers represented, then you would get the message, but you didn't necessarily need to. And then it was just like a kind of safe cocooning space to come and chill out in. You know, like it was an interactive piece, so people would come to the gallery and get into the fort, and people would kind of stay there for quite a long time and just sort of be like, you know, in a kind of calm space. And I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, like a big cuddle.
Yeah.
Kind of, or something like that. Yeah, there's something quite primitive about it. And I do think, I mean, that's quite analogous, I think, to the way I would feel about stitching, the way it made my soul feel. It was just like being wrapped into something.
Yeah.
Just a nice like feeling.
Yeah, definitely.
Did you stitch when you were little?
No.
No.
No, because that's...
But you've got quite a crafty family, right?
Yeah. So I'm from a family of artists. You know, my dad's a light, he makes light installations. My aunt's a painter. You know, we have like Oscar winners and like kind of going back through the generations, all Wimpresses have been artists. Like you are not allowed to be an accountant if you're a Wimpress. Like that's just not going to fly.
I mean, you'd be a hell of an accountant.
Yeah. Well, maths makes me cry, so that's definitely not going to work. So definitely raised in a creative environment, not necessarily a crafty environment. So yeah, didn't really do any stitching growing up, like maybe some cross stitch in school. But that's kind of it. Like I really sort of found embroidery myself rather than having it introduced to me at a young age.
So you did photography as a degree?
Yes.
Where did you think that was going to be the way you were going to go?
Yeah, for a while, like I had real ambitions of being like the next Tim Walker from Vogue and kind of like doing all these mad photo shoots. And then I thought, oh, maybe it's the set design that I prefer. And like, I kind of knew within the first half a year of my 3-year degree that I didn't want to be a photographer. And I sort of just wanted to escape my hometown. Like that was, right. You know, and it was a case of like, well, how do I do that? Go to uni, get loads of student loan, you know, do that kind of journey, because how else do you do it? Like, I don't regret kind of doing photography. It's proved useful, you know, just in terms of that skill, and, you know, made lifelong friends who I, you know, still adore. And but yeah, leaving that degree kind of after 3 years of knowing that I didn't want to do it, and then just being pushed out into the world, just going, what now? Like, what now? What next? I have no idea on what I want to do. And so I was just kind of working as a waitress in a Chinese buffet, which was god awful. You know, I would watch them drop plates of food on the floor and then just scoop it back up and put it out. Like, it was bad. And you know, having huge split shifts between the lunch and the dinner and just needing something to do. And so I just kind of took myself off to a haberdashery shop and thought, yeah, sure, let's give that a go. I got Gutermann sewing machine thread. That's what I first started stitching with. You know, that's how little I knew, and taught myself. Yeah.
And the rest was history.
Yeah, exactly. Love at first stitch is what I say. Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny when it gets you, isn't it? Mm. Do you think that, like, looking back, are there takeaways from the degree? It's a different medium, but I would guess that there's stuff to do with composition, design, those kind of things. Is this stuff that stuck with you?
Yeah, I think that's sort of kind of been drilled in, you know, like the rule of thirds and kind of all of this stuff that, you know, I probably wouldn't kind of necessarily think about. It's just kind of naturally comes out. I think I've blanked most of my photography degree out of my brain.
How much of a gap was there between that and the MA then?
Graduated photography 2012, did the master's in 2016 or 2015.
Right.
So a couple of years.
And was there a feeling like, because contemporary craft's an interesting one to go for, isn't it? I mean, was that something that gradually crept up on you?
No, I mean, so I did my master's in the same place that I did my BA, which was Plymouth College of Art. It was the first year that they had opened up the master's course. So, you know, because I did my BA there and because it was the first year, got a reduced rate and all this kind of stuff. And they were doing masters for multiple disciplines. So, you know, my friends who did photography, they did their photography masters there as well, same year. But contemporary craft was sort of the one that I thought I would fit into. And then kind of halfway through, you know, it was only a year, halfway through, I thought, oh, I should have been fine art, really. But it was too late to change. So contemporary craft it was. Yeah. And, you know, the kind of the head of contemporary craft was, I think he was a glass artist. So, you know, like a really different discipline. So you were very much just kind of left to get on with it, which is what an MA is. You know, they just leave you to do your own thing, basically. And you just kind of, it was more a year to figure out if I was an artist, I suppose, and if it was something that was kind of possible for me to pursue. And like, you know, I'd already kind of turned embroidery into a side hustle in the sense of making small one-off pieces to sell on Etsy. You know, again, another journey that I think a lot of embroiderers do, trying to sell one-off pieces and then realizing that no one will buy it because if you price it correctly, no one is.
Yeah, right. Yeah. £1,000.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I was kind of like, I had a couple of set patterns that I was really churning out over and over again. and it started to feel quite commercial. And I was like, oh no, I want to be an artist. And so I did my MA, kind of went back to commercial after that. And like, because yeah, I need to pay rent.
And was that something that felt okay to do, to go commercial?
Yeah. It's still, I think it's still something that I struggle with, and kind of at sort of low points, I don't necessarily feel like an artist. And then when I'm feeling good, I'm like, I'm an embroidery artist. You know, like I wrote that on the census. What year was that? 2021, when the census came around.
Right, okay.
To write your occupation. Yeah. And I was so proud typing out embroidery artist. Like, that's there for history, you know? Like, yes.
I think I might have put craft phenomenon. Just why not?
Oh, God. I love that.
The easiest way, I can't say what I am at all. It never works. But no, that's interesting, because you do, don't you? You get this tension then as you go on between producing, and in a way, I guess it's a reflection of art versus craft versus design debate and that sort of thing, you know. But for a lot of people that, you know, there's people I've spoken to, there's no way on God's earth they could be commercial, because they have to make that piece. That piece is coming out of them, whether they like it or not. I always think about Audrey Montoya and her awesome needle felted creations.
Yeah.
Like with eyes on them, the toasted cheese sandwich of despair, whatever it is, you know, that stuff that she could make. And she couldn't make a kit of that if she wanted to, because that's not the way she's constructed. And then there are other people, I think, who that kind of commercial, I would almost say more designering thing, like a one-to-many appeal, comes more naturally. Do you feel that it comes naturally to you?
I mean, it must do, because I've been doing it for 5 years.
Yeah, right. Yeah, congratulations, by the way. Five-year anniversary you. And all that. Yeah, cool.
Yeah, I mean, I still design things that I personally would want to stitch.
Mm-hmm.
And then just hope to God that other people also want to stitch them.
Yeah.
And, you know, but just doing the maths, you know, I could stitch the one hoop and try and sell that and maybe get 250 quid for it, if that. Or I could stitch the one hoop, make kits out of it, and get 10 grand from that one hoop. Like, that's kind of where I kind of had to land. And, you know, the business was set up so quickly that I didn't really have time to think about it. You know, my friend gave me the idea for a subscription box, and then within 3 weeks we'd launched. Like,
yeah. And it went off like a rocket. Didn't you say something like, I need like 50 people in order for this to earn more than my secretary job?
Yeah.
And within a month you got like 55 people or something.
Yeah, exactly. So
that must be crazy exciting.
I was lucky that I'd already kind of got to 10,000 followers on Instagram. You know, this is back when that meant something and it was really exciting. So I'd already kind of, over the 4 years of just doing stuff, built that kind of following up. So when I did launch, there was kind of that base level of support, which is really amazing. And yeah, it was really exciting and it was really unexpected. You know, for the fifth birthday, I was kind of going back and looking back through old posts and like kind of seeing the evolution. And you know, I had just no idea what I was doing at the beginning. And I still don't think I do now, but, you know, I definitely know more.
I mean, that was almost, I might be wrong, but it felt like that's probably around the time of like riding the first wave of subscription boxes, because it was definitely a thing, wasn't it? Where suddenly people were like, oh yeah, you know, I can think of quite a few people who've gone, this has worked quite well. Like you say, mathematically, real smart move.
Yeah.
I don't imagine you had a lot of peer support.
Yeah. So, you know, my friend gave me the idea because she had a cake subscription box, which she'd had for a little while. So, you know, she kind of thought, you know, if I can do it with cake, then you can do it with embroidery kits. And at the time of launching, I'd never even owned an embroidery kit. I'd never bought an embroidery kit. I'd never seen what goes into one, let alone made one myself. So it was really ambitious to kind of go, yeah, I can do that. But yeah, and you know, this was May 2020, so lockdown was still in effect. People were at home needing something to do with all this free time that they suddenly had. And, you know, that first year it was a monthly subscription. So I was like designing, stitching, ordering, packaging, a brand new kit every single month, which is, yeah, that quickly kind of got too much.
How quick? 6 months?
It was a year. I think it was a year.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, that's good in a way. Like, I remember once I tried to do a 52 challenge when I turned 40, I think. So I was going to do a new pattern every week for 52 weeks. And in the end, that nearly killed me because that was a pretty big ask. But you put in the reps, don't you?
Yeah. Like, it gave me a good foundation of kind of knowing what works and what didn't and stuff like that. But, just the kind of burnout. The burnout happened quite rapidly doing it every month. And, trying to think of something new and interesting to stitch for people. And then, we kind of came out of lockdown and people started going back to their normal lives, and suddenly they didn't have time to stitch a whole new thing every single month. So I went bi-monthly for my own sanity and also for my customers. And then in the last month, we've decided to go quarterly. So quite, beginning with 12 kits a year and now we're at four. And again, that was sort of for my own sanity. I started to really kind of feel bit like a hamster on a wheel. Like, I couldn't get off and couldn't stop, and I had to be designing and stitching and marketing and doing all of that stuff. But also, my customers were in a cost of living crisis. They've got less money. They've got no time to stitch. I heard it so often that people, they were going, I've got kits piling up and no time to do them, and at some point they're going to cancel their subscription because of that. And I have incredibly loyal customers who would get every single design even though they had kits piling up, but I knew that wasn't sustainable. Like, that's feels like a huge compliment kind of thing. But I didn't want them to feel that pressure, and also I didn't kind of really want to encourage that kind of almost overconsumption, I guess. Like, they felt like they had to have it even though they weren't going to use it. Like, that wasn't what I kind of wanted. And so, yeah, going quarterly. So now people have 3 months to stitch and it's still the same cost. So that kind of spreads the cost out. Feels a bit more manageable for them and me, I guess. But bloody terrifying, because that's just a third of my income. Like, But
yeah, it's a funny tension, isn't it? Like, I can remember, like, say with my magazine, effectively at this point in time, I've stopped the magazine. I hope to do an annual one. But the thought of going back to a quarterly schedule, even that's just like relentless.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I don't understand. When I look at some of my peers, some of the other cross-stitch magazines, I've got no idea how cross-stitch magazine can come out with stuff once a month. I can sort of understand why there's a certain similarity to a lot of the content, because needs must, and having original ideas on that frequency. Like I say, for me, solo doing it, and like you say, there's just this cycle of, you hit a deadline for production and then it's marketing and then it's project managing the next one, and on and on and on it goes. For joining me on another Needle Exchange. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'd love to hear from you, so feel free to email hello@needle.exchange, that's needle.exchange, with any thoughts, comments or feedback. And if you want to keep up with all the news, sign up to the Needle Exchange mailing list at bit.ly/needle exchange. See you next time.